The coronavirus is at the center of what everybody is talking about and thinking about. It was at the center of the debates, the presidential debate and the vice presidential debate. It is at the center of what's going on in neighborhoods of New York and other places where you're seeing lockdowns and protests against the lockdowns. Today on the Der Show, I'm going to talk about the debates, and I'm going to talk about the coronavirus, and I'm going to focus on the neighborhood of Brooklyn that I grew up in, which now has one of the highest rates of infection of coronavirus. So today on the Der Show, debates, coronavirus, and your health. The vice presidential debate the other night was far more civil and informative in many ways than the presidential debate, but I think the American public was denied what it was entitled to in the vice presidential debate, and that is answers to very hard questions. In each case, both the vice president and the senator refused to answer absolutely appropriate questions, and the moderator didn't press them hard enough to answer the questions. Senator Harris was asked, quite appropriately, would she advocate court packing in the event that the Democrats win the presidency and win the Senate? They could easily, just by a majority vote and no veto by the president, expand the number of Supreme Court justices from 9 to 11, 13, 15, 17, 27. There's an op-ed in today's New York Times by a writer saying it would be a good idea. And what's wrong with a 37-member Supreme Court? It would allow for more diversity. It would allow the court to reflect the image of America and the politics of America. It would become a Supreme Court more responsive to the political needs of America. In other words, it would abolish the Supreme Court and turn it into yet another branch of the democratic aspects of the government, the popular will, rather than a check and balance on the popular will of the government. So she had an obligation to answer that question. She wouldn't do it. And the moderator should have said to her, look, you have two choices in this debate, just two choices. Either answer the question or publicly acknowledge in clear terms that you are refusing to answer the question and explain why. And she should have been pressed on that, and she wasn't. And the same thing is true with the vice president. He was asked a very important question. He was asked, what would you do as vice president if President Trump lost the election but refused to leave office? He could have answered that question very easily, saying, it's hypothetical, it's not going to happen, the president is going to leave if the courts uphold the results of the election, and I'm not going to speculate as to what I would do, I would follow the law. He could have said that, but he didn't. He ducked the question, completely evaded the question, and I think he had an obligation to answer it. There were a number of other questions as well that were ducked. I'm not going to get into them in detail now. You remember them if you watch the debate. My point is this. The format of debates, both presidential and vice presidential, should demand answers to specific questions. You get so many incidents where a question is asked, and then the answer is, well, let me talk about the previous question, or let me tell you what I think about something that wasn't the subject of the question, or let me give you a little bit of a history lesson. No, the moderator should say, I asked a question, you're running for president or vice president, answer the question. Maybe that should happen in the next presidential debate, if there is a next presidential debate. We're now having all kinds of turmoil about whether you can have a debate. The Committee on the Debate, which is supposed to be nonpartisan, has said, let's have a debate, but it should be remote. President Trump has said, no, that's not a debate if it's remote. You can't check on whether or not the participants are getting fed answers. You have to rely on their honesty, and these days in America, nobody's relying on anybody's honesty. There is an intermediate solution, obviously, and that is you could have a debate in a room, much like the Pence-Harris debate, where you have plexiglass, where there's no contact, you can raise the plexiglass, You could have booths in which they are sitting, which completely isolate and protect everybody from any contagion. You don't have to go to the extreme of having it remote. The American public is entitled to more debates. We're entitled to have these questions put to the candidates and answered. We are entitled not to be buying pigs and pokes. I'm not comparing any of our candidates to pigs or the election to pokes, but the expression means you're allowed to know what you're getting. And you can't know what you're getting if candidates routinely refuse to answer questions and if moderators won't press them to answer their questions. Now, the media did a pretty good job in identifying the questions that both candidates in the vice presidential debate refused to answer, and they were held accountable for that in the court of public opinion. But it'd be much better to press them on the debate stage. Asked you a specific question, court packing, yes or no, or why won't you tell us? What would you do if the president refused to leave office? Tell us specifically. Don't talk about it as a hypothetical. We're entitled to your views on what would happen, what if. We're entitled to know what you would do in the worst case scenario, not only in the best case scenario. So we still have time to put these and other questions directly to the candidates for president. And let's hope the next debate, the next debates, if there are going to be debates, are more specifically focused. Let's hope they have the civility of the vice presidential debate, the energy of the presidential debate, and the answers to questions that appeared in neither debate. So we can only hope that we will get more information and all of us should vote. I am, in fact, voting today by absentee ballot. I've just looked at the ballot and made my decision about who to vote for, not only for president, but for Congress and for various judgeships in the state that I vote and referendum. This is the first time in my life I'm voting for a president absentee. I love going to the polls and meeting my neighbors and talking to them and seeing kids coming and being shown what voting is like in America. I'm going to miss that this year. Those of you who can vote in person, please do if you can do it safely without risking your health. Those of you who can't, please vote by mail. But vote. Failing to vote in America is giving up on democracy. And we can't give up on democracy. If you don't vote, don't complain. You have no right to complain unless you voted. If you vote, that's your ticket in. That's your ticket to complain. You know, my mother used to have a favorite joke about the old Jewish man who was almost turning 80, and he says to God, God, I prayed to you all of my life. I just want one thing from you before I turn 80. I want to win the New York lottery. He prays every day to win the New York lottery. He turns 80. He does not win the New York lottery. He rails at God, and he said, God, I just asked you for one thing to win the New York lottery. I prayed to you for so many years. Why didn't you let me win the New York lottery? A voice from heaven comes down and says, hey, help me out a little. Buy a ticket. He didn't buy the ticket. How do you expect to win the lottery? Buy a ticket. Vote. That's your ticket. If you want to see democracy thrive in America, buy a ticket. Vote. You don't even have to buy it. It's free. The Constitution doesn't permit poll tax. You get to vote free. And hopefully you get to vote either in person or by mail, whichever suits your medical and other conditions. So please vote. Having talked about the debates in which the coronavirus obviously played a central role, I want to shift now to the coronavirus itself. Those of you who know my views know that I've always taken the position, I've taken this position for 50 years. If you're a person of the left, if you're a liberal, if you're a Democrat, then you have a special obligation to condemn the excesses of the left, the hard left, Antifa, the racism of some people on the hard left, the bigotry, the anti-Semitism, etc. If you're a person of the right, if you're a conservative, you have a special obligation to condemn the extremism on the right, the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, others like that. that's why I was somewhat critical of President Trump when he said there were good people on both sides. Now, he didn't mean good people among the Nazis. Let's be clear. What he said and what he meant was there are good people on both sides of the debate about whether the monument should come down. He's gotten a bad rap on that. But I think he should have gone out of his way to say, look, I'm a person of the right. The people on the right support me. So I'm going to specially condemn those people on the right, even the people who were opposed to taking down monuments. If you're engaging in violence or disruptive conduct, I want you to know as a person of the right that I don't accept that. I don't want your support if your support is going to be based on any kind of bigotry or unlawful behavior. The left should condemn the left. The right should condemn the right. And it's in that spirit that I want to talk a little bit today about the neighborhood I grew up in. I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up in an insular, modern Orthodox neighborhood called Borough Park. Many of you probably never heard of Borough Park, but some of you may have heard of it recently because it has become an epicenter of the spread of the coronavirus. There are many others as well, but I care deeply about Borough Park because those are the streets I grew up in. I went to school in Borough Park. I shopped in Borough Park. My grandparents lived in Borough Park. My parents lived in Borough Park. I grew up in Borough Park, and I care deeply about the neighborhood. The neighborhood's changed since I grew up there. When I grew up, it was a modern Orthodox neighborhood. Almost everybody was Jewish, and almost all the Jews were modern Orthodox. Today, almost everybody is Jewish, but most of them are Hasidim, Haredi Jews, ultra-Orthodox Jews. And so it's not my Borough Park, but it's still the Borough Park I grew up in. And my parents were very Orthodox. My grandparents were very Orthodox. So why has Borough Park become an epicenter of the coronavirus? Because too many of the Jewish leaders in Borough Park haven't been tough enough on their congregants, haven't been telling them, look, you have to wear masks. You have to socially distance. You have to stop going to large funerals and weddings with hundreds, sometimes thousands of people standing close together. You're not going to develop herd immunity in Borough Park. It's not a big enough neighborhood for that to occur. And look what happened in Sweden, where they experimented with herd immunity and they had the highest rates in the region. So there's no excuse for it. The people of Borough Park say, look, we're being discriminated against. They may be right. There was no concern when there were demonstrations in the streets by people of the left for Black Lives Matter and other kinds of protests. People weren't required to wear a mask. Many did not. People were not required to socially distance. Many did not. And the mayor and the governor really didn't do much about that. Now they're opening up restaurants and they're opening up other places where people gather, but they're saying synagogues and funerals and weddings that are Orthodox Jewish, we're going to impose special restrictions on those, no more than 10 people, etc. There is a plausible claim of discrimination, and that can be taken up in court. In fact, a lawsuit has been filed in that regard. I'm not talking about the lawsuit. Indeed, I'm not even talking about the law. I'm talking about basic common sense and decency. And if I'm going to talk about the law at all, I'm actually briefly going to talk about Jewish law, because these are people who claim to be observing Jewish law. I studied Jewish law for many years as a yeshiva student in Borough Park, in Brooklyn. And what I came away from is Choose Life, the great portion in the book of Deuteronomy where God says, I have placed before you life and death. Choose life so that you and your children may live. That's what the Bible demands. Choose life, not illness. Don't endanger your children. Don't endanger your neighbors. Many of the books of the Bible focus on what happens when you have a communicable disease. In the book of Leviticus, there's descriptions of people who have skin diseases that could be contagious, and the Bible mandates that they be isolated beyond the walls of the city and kept separate, an early form of social distancing and preventive measures. The Bible is filled with obligations to wash hands and remain clean, choose life. That's the message that the leaders of Borough Park and other communities ought to be giving to their congregants and their followers. Choose life. Choose health. Don't expose yourself needlessly. You know, the Talmud says, he who saves a single human life, it's as if they saved the world. And the corollary is, he who needlessly takes a single human life, it is as if they have taken the whole world. The Jewish people have gone through many crises before. Pogroms, the Holocaust, attacks on Israel, plagues. And they've always adapted. They've adapted. The obligation to go to a wedding or a funeral is not nearly as important in Jewish law as the obligation to preserve life and save life. So my message to my fellow Borough Parkers is, please do the sensible thing. Bring your lawsuits, file your grievances, complain, vote against the candidates you think are discriminating against you. That's one issue. But then the issue is, what are you going to do personally? And personally, you should wear masks, you should socially distance, you should stay away from large-scale events where people are not wearing masks and socially distancing. That's your obligation. The Bible also talks about being kind to strangers. And when some strangers came to Borough Park to report on what was going on and to report on the mask burning, some people, I don't want to generalize, this wasn't the whole community, some people spit at them. That's not what the Bible calls for. So my message to you is, go back, read your sources, read the Bible. It's a wonderful document. Read the Jewish laws. Read Maimonides, who was a doctor and who cared deeply about protecting health and life. This is a message that I give now to my community, my old community of Borough Park, but it's a message to all Americans. Indeed, it's a message to people all around the world. Be safe, both for your own good, the good of your family, and the good of your community. You need to make sure that the virus doesn't spread beyond where it is and has been. We have no idea what the future of this virus is. We don't know whether it's going to spike or it's going to be reduced. We've never experienced anything like this before. The experts have not always been right, but you should always accept the most cautious advice from the experts. Obviously, we want to restart the American economy. Obviously, we want to get back to being able to go to the theater and listen to concerts and go to weddings and go to funerals. Those are all very, very important things to do, but it will only get worse if you don't take short-term efforts and steps to keep the virus in check. And so today we talked about two things, and they're related to each other. We talked about the debates. We talked about the focus of the debates on the coronavirus. Coronavirus is going to have a major impact on this election. This election, in some ways, is going to be a referendum on whether the current administration dealt wisely, well, and effectively with the threat of the virus, and whether or not the opposing party would have done better. It's easy to criticize from the sidelines. Would they have done better? That's a decision voters are going to have to make. But putting aside the issue of who you vote for and what cases you bring in court, just be sensible. Follow medical advice, cautious conservative medical advice, masks, social distancing, hand washing. That's the Jewish way. That's the American way. That's the way that all people around the world should operate. So please, 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 keep America safe, keep America healthy, keep America a democracy. Vote on Election Day, vote on the polls if you can get there safely and healthily, vote by mail if you can't. We are a great, great democracy. We will survive this. All of us will survive this, except for those, tragically, who will die in the process, and we have to minimize those deaths. So that's my message for today on the Dirt Show. I promised you, you'd never be bored. Now it's time for your questions. Brian from Toronto.
At the end of your program, you asked the question about AOC and whether or not she is the future of the party or way to left. And your question was framed in as an either-or question. And in my mind, the very unfortunate reality is that she is both the future of the Democratic Party and way, way to left. Unfortunately, the people who think like you are getting fewer and fewer and fewer. Good luck. I really hope that you win this battle of ideas. And Shana Tova and Chag Sameach.
Well, thank you so much for your good wishes. And I think you're right. I think she is potentially the future of the Democratic Party unless we can do something to prevent that. And she is far too left, far too radical. She calls her organization the Jacobins. Does she even know history? The Jacobins were bloodthirsty mass murderers who came in the middle of the French Revolution and started to guillotine innocent people. What does she think she is when she calls herself a Jacobin? Is she next going to call herself the Khmer Rouge or the Bolsheviks? Why would you name yourself after a group of terrorists? Remember, the word terrorism comes from the Reign of Terror, which was done by the Jacobins, Robespierre, and others during the French Revolution. So I agree with you. I think she has moved far, far, far to the left. She won't deal with any pro-Israel people at all, even people on the hard, hard left of the pro-Israel movement. Anything that smacks of Zionism or pro-Israel is anathema to her. And so I'm going to work very hard to try to marginalize her within the Democratic Party. If she ever became the future of the Democratic Party, I could no longer remain a Democrat. So thanks a lot for your observation. Our next caller is from Nevada. Harvey?
Good morning. Harvey Cohen, Nevada. Can you tell us, worst case scenario, what would happen if the court was packed? Let's say you have 15 Supremes. What's the worst case scenario? Give us three instances. And don't give us Roe and Obamacare. Those we know. What's the worst that could happen? Thank you and stay well. Bye.
Thanks for your great question. I think there are two worst things that could happen. One, institutionally. So the Democrats expand the court to 13, and they load it with liberal Democrats. And then the Republicans get elected. They control the Senate and the presidency as they do now. And they increase it from 15 to 19. And they load it with their people. Then the Democrats come back and they increase it from 19 to 23. It'd go on forever and ever. It would turn the Supreme Court into yet another political institution and would really eliminate our system of checks and balances. The Supreme Court was supposed to be an elitist institution, not subject to the whims of the majority. It was supposed to represent the most disenfranchised people. Of course, historically, it's also represented the wealthiest and the most elite. It's had a mixed record and a mixed history. It's done some great things and some awful things. It contributed to the beginning of the Civil War with its Dred Scott horrible decision about slaves and emancipated slaves not being able to be full citizens of the United States under the Constitution. It's had other terrible decisions, allowing for the detention of over 100,000 Americans of Japanese origin to be put in detention centers during the Second World War, allowing the sterilization of people who were thought to be mentally impaired. But it's also done great things, desegregating the schools, creating equal rights for gays and other people. And so I think it would just hurt the Supreme Court's credibility. I don't think the worst case scenario involves overruling particular cases. We can live with that. What we can't live with as a country is the elimination of the Supreme Court as an important check and balance on the excesses of the popular branches of the government. please call in with your observations, comments, questions, criticism. The number is 216-710-0050. 24/7, we'll take and record your calls. You can also listen to this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and you can listen 24/7. You can't sleep at night. Listen to the podcast. I'm not going to put you to sleep. I promise you that, because I'm never boring. But if you want to stay up and listen anytime you want.